Good afternoon, Radio Free Brooklyn. It's 1 p.m. and you're listening to Objection to the Rule. Coming up, the president made a bad situation worse this week with his comments after Charlottesville. Is this the final straw in his presidency? What could possibly come next, right? And now that it seems that more have become aware of the racist underpinnings of this country, what's going to happen about it? Are there going to be any changes? We'll talk about that later. Plus, Steve Bannon is out. What does that mean for the president's agenda? And is it a concern that he went directly back to Breitbart? Plus, we'll talk with Jeff Jones from the Fair Fares campaign to explore how access to public transportation could help some of our more disenfranchised New Yorkers. And finally, we're joined by guest reporter Ashika Jegru, who covers protest movements. He's going to give us some insight on this whole Antifa movement that everybody's been talking about. So you're listening to Objection to the Rule on Radio Free Brooklyn. Hey, everyone. Welcome to Objection to the Rule.
Hey.
How's it going? I have been messing up all weekend turning on microphones. We just got our fourth microphone back, so I've been turning on the third microphone for everyone. So now people can hear you, Ash.
How's Yay. It going?
Welcome to Objection to the Rule. It is 1:02 here in our studio in Bushwick. We are live, and we have a special guest in the studio, Ashika Jegru. Thanks for joining
Hi.
Us.
Hi. Thanks for having me here.
Yeah, so we go back to the J School Times, and
Word.
It has been an interesting couple of weeks in politics, in social justice. So we're going to talk all about that over the next hour. But the big news this week really is the fallout from the president's comments on Charlottesville and the massive counter protests against white supremacy across the country. Last week, we talked about how the president's response fell short. He made another response later that specifically condemned white supremacy and the KKK. But then he seemed to retract, going back to his original statements about blaming both sides. And he specifically came out to talk about how he was sad about the monuments being removed. So we're going to talk a little bit about those answers, I guess those responses that he made in the press and some of the fallout from that. But here's a little bit of those remarks.
The alt-left that came charging at the, as you say, the alt-right, do they have any semblance of guilt? Let me ask you this. What about the fact they came charging with clubs in their hand, swinging clubs? Do they have any problem? I think they do. You had a group on one side that was bad, and you had a group on the other side that was also very violent. And nobody wants to say that, but I'll say it right now. You had a group on the other side that came charging in without a permit, and they were very, very violent.
Go ahead. Do you think that what you call the alt-left is the same as neo-Nazis?
All of those people, I've condemned neo-Nazis. I've condemned many different groups, but not all of those people were neo-Nazis, believe me. Not all of those people were white supremacists by any stretch. Those people were also there because they wanted to protest the taking down of a statue, Robert E. Lee. So, excuse me, and you take a look at some of the groups and you see, and you know it if you were honest reporters, which in many cases you're not, but many of those people were there to protest the taking down of the statue of Robert E. Lee. So, this week it's Robert E. Lee. I noticed that Stonewall Jackson's coming down. I wonder, is it George Washington next week? And is it Thomas Jefferson the week after? You know, you really do have to ask yourself, where does it stop? But they were there to protest, excuse me, you take a look the night before, they were there to protest the taking down of the statue of Robert E. Lee.
Are you putting what you're calling the alt-left and white supremacists on the same moral plane?
I'm not putting anybody on a moral plane. What I'm saying is this. You had a group on one side and you had a group on the other, and they came at each other with clubs, and it was vicious, and it was horrible, and it was a horrible thing to watch. But there is another side. There was a group on this side, you can call them the left, you've just called them the left, that came violently attacking the other group. So you can say what you want, but that's the way it is.
You said there was hatred, there was violence on both sides.
I do think there's blame. Yes, I think there's blame on both sides. You look at both sides. I think there's blame on both sides, and I have no doubt about it, and you don't have any doubt about it either.
And
if you reported it accurately, you would say.
They showed up in Charlottesville.
And you had some very bad people in that group. But you also had people that were very fine people on both sides. You had people in that group. Excuse me. I saw the same pictures as you did. You had people in that group that were there to protest the taking down of, to them, a very, very important statue and the renaming of a park from Robert E. Lee to another name. George Washington was a slave owner. Was George Washington a slave owner? So will George Washington now lose his status? Are we going to take down statues to George Washington? How about Thomas Jefferson? What do you think of Thomas Jefferson? You like him? Okay, good. Are we going to take down the statue? Because he was a major slave owner. Now, are we going to take down his statue? So you know what? It's fine. You're changing history. You're changing culture. And you had people, and I'm not talking about the neo-Nazis and the white nationalists, because they should be condemned totally. But you had many people in that group other than neo-Nazis and white nationalists, okay? And the press has treated them absolutely unfairly. Now, in the other group also, you had some fine people, but you also had troublemakers, and you see them come with the black outfits and with the helmets and with the baseball bats. You had a lot of bad people in the other group too.
The press treated unfairly, sir. I'm sorry. I just understand what you were saying. You were saying the press has treated white nationalists unfairly.
No.
I just understand what you were saying.
No. There were people in that rally, and I looked the night before. If you look, they were people protesting very quietly the taking down of the statue of Robert E. Lee. I'm sure in that group there were some bad ones. The following day it looked like they had some rough, bad people, neo-Nazis, white nationalists, whatever you want to call them. But you had a lot of people in that group that were there to innocently protest and very legally protest because, you know, I don't know if you know, they had a permit. The other group didn't have a permit. So I only tell you this. There are two sides to a story. I thought what took place was a horrible moment for our country. A horrible moment. But there are two sides to the country.
So that two sides narrative has been coming up multiple times. There's both sides. Sometimes it's many sides. There's all these sides. I want to know first what you thought of the president's characterization of what happened, Ash. How do you think he presented it? And do you think that he presented it fairly?
Well, I'm not surprised about what he said. I mean, I think from the beginning, before during the campaign, we knew he's a fascist pretty much. Mm-hmm. And I'm not surprised what he spews fascist apologetics when he sees mm-hmm. something like Charlottesville. The funny thing about the both sides and many sides thing is that only maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, a lot of like centrist liberals were using the same exact argument against people to their left, mm-hmm. Saying, well, you know, if Antifa didn't come out, these right wingers wouldn't get the attention that they so desperately crave. There's violence on both sides. You have to get Peter Beinhart actually wrote an article for The Atlantic mm-hmm. talking about the violence of the alt-left or whatever, the violence of the left or whatever, and pretty much saying the exact same thing Trump says, that, you know, that Antifa drives the violence as well as the right wingers, and that there's violence on both sides, and that, you know, both sides need to be condemned. But then when Trump came out and said, you know, there's violence on both sides. It became kind of like taboo to say that almost now. Like, people are very reluctant to say both sides.
That's a really interesting point that, you know, and a lot of, you know, the rhetoric shifting to kind of accommodate who we want to target at any given time. That's not something that's new, but it is interesting as we've come through, you know, this election period, and you see this idea of the left kind of getting picked apart, essentially. Like, what does it mean? Who are these groups? What does it mean to be far left versus centrist left? What does it mean to be liberal? You know, and so we're exploring kind of what these things mean, and we're finding that there's a lot of kind of discrepancy. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, you know, how do you think that you talking about the election, how do you think that the failure of like the Democratic Party to kind of identify these issues more strongly and not paint them as just this very far, very fringe activity. How do you think that affected how this played out and what we're seeing now?
Yeah. I mean, personally, I have no faith in the Democratic Party or the party system in general, obviously.
Yeah.
But I think the Democrats kind of shoot themselves in the foot when they pretty much don't like take on things like single payer health care and stuff like take on class issues. I mean, Steve Bannon, when he just got kicked out recently, said he was glad about the Charlottesville fallout because while the Democrats are talking about race or whatever, he'll talk about quote unquote economic nationalism, whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, the right wing, the fascists know that there's a class problem in this country. There's class inequality, and they're using that to their advantage, just like fascist movements of the past have used that.
So is it that idea that, you know, these kind of racial divisions, these social divisions are that tool that these fascist groups are using, or is it deeper than that?
Well, I think there are natural contradictions that come about from capitalism.
Yeah.
I mean, and fascists use these things, this discontent, this alienation that a lot of these white men feel, a lot of white people feel, this feeling of disempowerment. Mm-hmm. And they use this to their advantage. And there are solutions to these problems from the left. I mean, attacking class inequality, attacking poverty, attacking the fact that people can't get the healthcare they need. Police brutality is another thing. If we could solve these problems, these really deep problems, with real solutions instead of just, you know, more racism or kicking out the immigrants or letting police be more brutal to black and brown people and stuff like that, that's their solutions. Mm-hmm. If the left or the liberals could come up with real solutions except, you know, whining about how Trump is bad and that he's colluding with Russia or whatever, I think there could be some pushback. There could be some really harsh blows to the fascist movement, pretty much.
But it's not. It seems like that is not the game, the goal. It seems like there's another goal, on the part of, I guess, the Democratic Party.
Yeah,
it doesn't seem like that's the goal. I'm curious about this, the Confederate monuments that have become the center of conversation. You know, there are 718, according to the, you know, Southern Poverty Law Center, around 718 of these monuments all around the country. There are over 1,500 symbols of the Confederacy around the country, whether it's schools or army bases or streets named for these generals. There's discussion about what this means to get them removed and whether it is a kind of a band-aid on a larger problem. What do you think that removing these statues will do, if anything, to fix the unrest, the healing, you know, the issues that we have in this country with race or with inequality?
It's just scratching the surface of the problems, obviously. I don't want people to think that once we get rid of like Trump and once we take down all the Confederate statues and monuments, mm-hmm. that racism is gone, poof, and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. White supremacy is done with. I mean, there are a lot of other forms of white supremacy that we've been talking about. Police brutality, gentrification.
That's a really interesting point. And that's something that I've kind of seen as we fixate on this very like visual, very kind of visceral notion of white supremacy, these men with these torches, these mm-hmm. violent, you know, white nationalists. But there are so many different manifestations of white supremacy in our culture. How do we connect people from the very violent to the normal everyday, you know, microaggressions or the systems that exist? How do we get people to make that leap to understand that those are the same?
For me personally, one of the things that really made the connection really clear for me is like, I guess, getting on the streets and looking at the way police interact with Black Lives Matter, for example. Mm-hmm. The police are the frontline force for white supremacy in this country. It isn't the fascists with torches or whatever. Mm-hmm. They work hand in hand, but the police are the ones beating black and brown protesters down the street, throwing people in jail, facilitating a mass incarceration system that keeps black people enslaved to this day, pretty much. So just seeing that up close, and I remember recently, this girl from Black Lives Matter, Greater New York, they did a report back from Charlottesville maybe a day or two ago. And she even said that when she was on the front lines at Emancipation Park, I believe it's called, mm-hmm. She saw that the cops are right there while the white supremacists, the fascists were pretty much targeting her, trying to throw stuff at her. And they were just watching. And there were times where they would point guns at her, pretty much, and the cops would just stand there and watch. And she was like, if I had got shot in there, the cops would have just sat there and watched it all. And she even said at certain times, they were taking turns throwing stuff at the leftist protesters, at the Black Lives Matter protesters. She was like, it was clear, crystal clear right there that they work hand in hand. And I mean, and those are the cops on a daily basis who are arresting Black people for broken windows offenses or jumping the turnstile or any number of things that they arrest Black and brown people for.
That idea that, you know, the way that the police reacted to Charlottesville, the ones that were on the ground there, versus how other police departments have reacted to other protests, other manifestations, ones that are made up of more people of color, more Black people, there was a stark difference. And it was very noticeable. You didn't hear about the wide number of arrests or detainments from, you know, the white nationalists that were participating, that were enacting violence. You heard about the one guy that, you know, killed someone with a car being arrested, but you didn't hear about, you know, anybody that was inciting or enacting violence, you know, being detained. And that is it is an exact point to show the disparity in how these things are treated. I want to switch gears a little bit, and I'm curious about how we're in this period now where we are faced with talking about racism, we're faced with talking about, at least on a surface level, some of these ills that have been a part of this country since its inception. I'm curious, from your perspective, Violet, what have you seen in your, you know, in discussions about just how people are reacting to what happened? And is any of it surprising or shocking, or kind of what are your thoughts on how the country has responded to what happened?
I think people are attached to these symbols for more than what they are. They represent identity to them, even though that's an identity that's not really been acceptable for already like more than 100 years. Mm-hmm. Symbols have a value, even symbols of negativity. So like putting them in context, like having a way to understand what symbols of the Confederacy were and like the violence they represent is useful. Mm-hmm. But I don't think taking statues out is the same thing as erasure.
Mm-hmm. I'm beyond that. We have a place where we can't talk about history. We can't talk about the history of these statues, but not acknowledge that we don't teach the proper history about these statues. We don't teach the proper history about the Confederacy. We don't teach the proper history about slave ownership and the slave trade as an institution in this country and how much effect it had on building America. And so I feel like if we're going to have the discussion about history, we need to have the discussion about why our history is lacking in a well-rounded understanding of really how America began and all of the negative and, you know, genocidal ways that this country came to be. But we're not ready to acknowledge that yet.
Yeah, I was about to say, these statues don't make history any clearer. They obscure history, if anything. I mean, if you really want, if you're going to put forward that we need to keep these up for history's sake or whatever. Yeah. And I mean, historically, if you want to be historically correct, these statues, Confederate statues, were put up in reaction towards, you know, Black people trying to get their rights, pretty much, and like as a spit in the face of Black people.
Absolutely.
Trying to get their rights.
If you look at the data of when many of them were erected, and this was, you know, the SPLC put this out as well, there was a peak during the Jim Crow era, so the early 1900s, and then there was another peak during the Civil Rights era. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't about commemorating history. It's almost like we wanted to, you know, memorialize these scary things in, you know, Black and brown communities. It's like a reminder, you know, it's like we are in control here. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what it was saying. So the other news that happened this week, we could talk about that forever. And I feel like that story is going to continue as the fallout continues. But another thing that happened to the administration was the ouster of chief strategist Steve Bannon. And honestly, this is like, we talked about how we were seeing, We've seen this on the horizon as well. It was something that probably was going to happen a couple of weeks ago, as many people have reported these discussions were happening. But it was interesting, in the same press conference where President Trump talked about Charlottesville, he also made a comment about Steve Bannon. He was asked by a reporter what they thought of Bannon. So here is that clip, and I'm curious to know what your thoughts are.
About it.
Can you
tell us broadly what your do you have, still have confidence
well,
in Steve?
Well, we'll see. Hey, look, look. I like Mr. Bannon. He's a friend of mine. But Mr. Bannon came on very late. You know that. I went through 17 senators, governors, and I won all the primaries. Mr. Bannon came on very much later than that. And I like him. He's a good man. He is not a racist. I can tell you that. He's a good person. He actually gets a very unfair press in that regard. But we'll see what happens with Mr. Bannon. But he's a good person, and I think the press treats him, frankly, very unfairly.
It's always the press treating people unfairly. That's always a thing. But, you know, even in those words, it really seemed like he knew what was up. Like, that seemed like he's like, I'm just going to say these things, but, like, I can't say what I want to say. Did anybody else, either of you get that impression?
It's funny how all these people aren't racist in Trump's eyes. No one's a racist in Trump's eyes. There are no Nazis, or there's nothing wrong.
Except those white supremacists. They are bad. But who are they?
Right.
Yeah, exactly. He never points. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that Unite the Right rally was a call explicitly for all these fascist groups. I mean, there were no quote unquote good people at that.
There were, signs and everything that were submitted, like as far as like trying to get people to come to this, it pointed to these very white supremacist, white nationalist ideals. Like, it's hard to escape that.
Yeah. And with Bannon, I mean, Bannon wasn't a latecomer to this. Breitbart has been riding for Trump for the longest time, and they are like the brown shirts in the right wing press. They have always been like straight up rabid, foaming mouth fascists. They've been on board since the beginning, and they are racist to the core. Yeah.
And some of the things that have come out of that publication have been very inflammatory. And so it's very interesting that it's like a recategorization of the truth, right? It's like, it's almost, you know, to the point of gaslighting. It's like we're trying to paint this picture that all of us have seen the evidence to be the contrary, but this is the picture that we want to paint. What do you think will be the effect, the impact, if any, of Bannon now being outside of the administration? Or is he really outside of the administration?
I think, like, I've heard this from a number of different places, but like there's a sense to which each new thing that Trump comes out with, you can sort of like tell by what he says who was whispering in his ear at that moment. And it's like very clear, like the immigration ban, the Muslim ban, a lot of the like the worst things that he says and does have hints of notes of Bannon in them. But, you know, at his core, he's Trump. It's not like he's just like a blank slate. He is a man with his own ideas and thoughts. And so we'll probably, I don't know, it might be less overt, but it's still going to be the same tune, I think.
Yeah, Trump doesn't need Bannon to be a fascist himself, really. I mean, and I don't think Bannon's really out, per se. I mean, he's head at Breitbart still. That's the propaganda wing of the Trump administration, pretty much. I mean, he's still working for the president, even if he's not in the administration.
Isn't that almost more of a worry? You know, him going from the administration, having a very senior role, being, you know, kind of the right-hand man of Trump and being very involved in that piece, and then going to lead this, you know, quote-unquote news organization. Should we be worried? Like, I don't know. It's almost like now you have even more information about how the inside works. And it's like when you have that information, you're able to spin a lot better. Do you think that his involvement, having been involved in the government, will affect somehow what he puts out at Breitbart?
No, I think he'll be the same old Bannon, quite frankly. But just more, I guess, I'm not sure if he'll even be more unleashed, quite frankly, because he was pretty bad in the damn administration. I mean, I'm not sure exactly what the difference is, except superficially.
Okay.
Quite frankly. I mean, I remember when he got kicked off the National Security Council or whatever, everyone was like, oh, Bannon's gone. The witch is dead, pretty much. And like, no, he was still in there. Happened. Yeah, he's still in there. And I'm sure he'll still have conversations with Trump. They'll be on the phone with each other, talking to each other. And like Trump said it himself, he loves Bannon. He likes the guy. And he's a straight up Nazi himself, too. So he has regular conversation. He likes the Nazi guy. So it's not,
but
he's not gone.
There are no Nazis.
Yeah, there are no Nazis, though. Of course not. No.
Wow. It's, you know, it's very, I don't even want to, it's interesting is not the word. It's just been a lot of things that we were like hoping wouldn't happen, that we were looking and we were seeing like, oh, this is possible, but no, maybe possible. No. Yes. Yes. It's all actually, yeah. it's all happening. So that's, you know, that takes something from there. You should take something from that. We're going to continue the conversation in just a moment. We're going to play a little music, but I want to let everybody know, to help RFB get to South by Southwest, you can vote on RadioFreeBrooklyn.com/South by Southwest. We want to take our show on the road and present the great work we do at RFB to the people at South by Southwest. So share the word, help us get there by voting. Again, you can do that at RadioFreeBrooklyn.com/SXSW or South by Southwest. You have until August 25th to vote. So share often, let people know, get the word out, and vote for us to go to South by Southwest. We're going to play a little bit of music and we'll be back in just a moment right here on Objection to the Rule.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won, we will be sure, we will be sure. Oh, glory,
glory, glory.
Oh,
the heavens, no man, no weapon formed against, yes, glory is destined. Everyday women and men become legends. Sins that go against our skin become blessings. The movement is a rhythm to us. Freedom is like religion to us. Justice is juxtaposition in us. Justice for all just ain't specific enough. One son died, the spirit is revisiting us. True and living, living in us. Resistance is us. That's why Rosa sat on the bus. That's why we walked through Ferguson with our hands up. When it go down, we woman and man up. They say stay down, and we stand up. Shots be on the ground, the camera panned up. King pointed to the mountaintop, and we ran up.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won, we will be sure.
Every man, woman, and child. Even Jesus got his crown in front of a crowd. They march with the torch, we gon' run with it now. Never look back, we done gone hundreds of miles. From dark roads, heroes, to become a hero. Facing the League of Justice, his power was the people. Enemy is lethal, a king became regal. Saw the face of Jim Crow under a bald ego. The biggest weapon is to stay peaceful. We sing, our music is the cuts that we bleed through. Somewhere in the dream we had an epiphany. Now we right the wrongs in history. No one can win a war individually. It takes the wisdom of the elders and young people's energy. Welcome to the story we call victory. The coming of the Lord, my eyes have seen the glory.
One day, when the glory comes,
we'll be right back.
issue that's always on our minds in New York is public transit. When's the subway going to come? Is it going to break down in the tunnel? Or is any number of other calamities going to befall us while we're trying to get from point A to point B in the city? Something else that we might be thinking about is how much it's all going to cost. Those $2.75 can add up pretty quickly, especially if you don't have a lot to spare. The Community Service Society's annual Unheard Third survey found that about 1 in 4 low-income New Yorkers regularly has problems affording public transit.
And that's a lot.
That's Jeff Jones, Director of Marketing and Design for the Community Service Society. We spoke with him this week about Fair Fares, CSS's new initiative in partnership with the Riders Alliance to combat that issue. Fair Fares will provide half-price Metro cards to New Yorkers living at and below the poverty line. Here's Jeff on the campaign.
And so Nancy Rankin, our Vice President for Policy Research and Advocacy, reached out to the Riders Alliance, which is a nonprofit that is a transit-focused grassroots nonprofit. And we kind of formed a partnership and launched this campaign for Fair Fares. It's an interesting time right now. So we pushed really hard through this last budget cycle to get it in the city budget. We got, I mean, our coalition grew and grew. We had a ton of support. We have, I think we have 41 of 40 of the 51 city council members support it, 4 of the 5 borough presidents support it, the controller, the public advocate. We have like editorial endorsements from the Times, the Daily News, El Diario, a bunch of papers. I mean, it's just been huge amounts of support. And we got we came very close to getting a pilot in the city budget this year, but unfortunately it didn't happen.
Now, with Mayor de Blasio's new plan for the subway and its millionaire's tax to raise revenue, it looks like it's a good moment for Fair Fares. But when their initiative might get passed isn't clear yet.
Ooh, that's a big question. So it's a great idea. It's when we originally put out our report back in 2016 in April, we said, hey, there's a number of different ways we could pay for this. And this idea of a millionaire's tax was one of those ideas. We think it's great. The mayor seems to feel very confident that this is something that Albany would be willing to pass. But this is something, the state would have to do. So, outside of him lobbying, the governor and the state folks, we don't know. The governor has recently come out talking about congestion pricing as a way to fix the subway. And so we're really hopeful that the governor will include Fair Fares in whatever proposal he puts out to do fix the kind of infrastructure and other needs of the subway. And so we want to get it done. We're happy whichever way it goes, it should get done. We also feel that the mayor, so one of the things that we started with is the mayor has the ability to do this. The mayor doesn't need, despite the fact that the MTA is funded by is controlled by the state, the mayor can actually classify a discount for a group of people. He can say, all right, we're going to provide a discount for low-income New Yorkers, much like we have discounts for seniors or high school students. And he has the ability to do that. And with the budget that we have and how much this costs, we think that regardless of the millionaire's tax, regardless of what the governor does, this should be done and he could do it. So we're kind of still looking at right now, it's this kind of, let's see who's going to kind of prevail in the best plan to work on the subways. And we just want to make sure that Fair Fares is in that discussion and is part of every plan that comes out.
Lots of New Yorkers live at and below the poverty line, which is $24,000 a year for a family of 4. New Yorkers covered by Fair Fares would include undocumented immigrants because immigration status isn't a factor for income verification right now.
The goal of this is to help low-income New Yorkers access transit. And in a city like New York, if you can't access public transit, you can't do a lot of things, right? You can't get to work. You can't get to your doctor. If you're having to choose between, and we've spoken to folks, and we have stories up on our campaign website of people who literally are choosing between like getting a meal and getting a Metro card. Each person would save $726 a year in Metro card costs by this plan. And when you're living at the poverty level, that's a big chunk of change. And so, like I said, in our survey, we saw that like 1 in 4 New Yorkers said they couldn't afford it. This would really help.
Of course, it won't cover everyone who could use the reduced fare.
People that make a little bit more than that at 130% or 200% of poverty in New York City, that's still not a big income, and that can still be a big challenge with accessing the subway. This, like any sort of plan to help, this is what we feel is going to be a great start, a great thing that we can do. Ideally, we would love to see more people covered by it. But this is covering the people that need it the most now. Mayor de Blasio, ran on this idea of the Tale of Two Cities, being progressive, really helping the working poor. This is a huge way to help people in poverty. It's not just about like getting transit. It saves money. It's a poverty issue. It's a way to lift people up, get them on transit, save them money. What we're doing next, what the campaign is focused on, is really just making sure that this issue is part of the discussion around what's going on with the subways, is part of the discussion around the mayor's reelection. It's part of the discussion right now that this is something that needs to happen.
That was Jeff Jones. Thank you so much, Violet, for that interview. I'm curious, because this seems like a great program. It seems like it's going to benefit the people that really need it. We know that, $275 can be a burden for a lot of people. And, you have to do that, you think, 10 times a week if you're going to work a 5-day work week. That's a lot of money. So how do they plan to get this into, in front of all of the, people that need to make this action? Kind of what is their next step to bring visibility to this plan and get people on board?
Right. One thing that Jones said is that they've already had, they've had head nods from a lot of the people who are making these decisions. So the mayor is one, Governor Cuomo is another. Governor Cuomo has talked about congestion pricing, adding that to revenue to put out for public transit, and that's something that Fair Fares could use as well. But they might not need as much support as they're getting, because the mayor could do it himself. He could sign a bill. The way the MTA works is that they can divert funds for things like this, for projects like this. So it's not clear what would make the mayor or the governor or both say yes, but if they do, it could happen quickly.
And I feel like whoever does kind of take the reins of this and champions it, it's going to be a win for them. So I'm wondering if it matters, if it kind of matters who the win would be biggest for. Would it be a bigger win for Cuomo? Would it be a bigger win for de Blasio? I wonder if that's a part of this decision making, because this problem's been presented out there and this solution is now available. And I'm sure that as people are forming their kind of campaign platforms, discussing their campaign platforms, we have de Blasio up for re-election this year and Cuomo up for re-election next year. The MTA is going to be a big thing. It's going to be a big topic of discussion. Would following this plan, in your opinion, be the best decision, or is there a better alternative out there? Is there something that maybe would apply to more New Yorkers, or give more benefit to people that are outside of that very high poverty level?
Right. As far as I know, this is the most inclusive plan out there. If there's something else in the works, it doesn't have as much publicity and it doesn't have legs in the same way right now. But I feel like if this, I'll venture to say that if something like this goes through, that opens the door for a more inclusive plan, which is needed.
Absolutely. Now, Ashley, I'm curious what your thoughts are on a plan like this. Do you think that it really will have the impact on lower income New Yorkers, on people that are the most in need for, lower subway fares? Do you think that it will have the impact that it's kind of designed to have, or is there going to be some fallout? What are your kind of perspective on?
I think the Fair Fares thing is a good kind of reform, which, like you said, leads the way to leading to more inclusive projects. But we can't depend on these politicians to do this for us. And what's been left out is this is a race issue as well, because most of the people who are arrested for jumping the turnstile are black and brown people, poor black and brown people. This is the way that the cops, one of the most arrestable broken windows offenses is getting people for hopping the turnstile pretty much. Mm-hmm. And over 80% are black and brown. And I got to give a shout out to the Swipe It Forward campaign, hashtag Swipe It Forward. These are basically a coalition of activist groups who go out to, you know, major train stations and swipe people in for free. Mm-hmm. And also tell people, like, if you have an unlimited Metro card and you're walking out the subway, swiping somebody, swiping, especially if they're a poor black and brown person.
Absolutely. And it's a, you know, it's to clarify, there is not a law against that. It's completely
legal.
Yeah,
it's completely legal
to do that.
Yeah.
You know, there are laws about selling Metro cards and swipes and things like that. But if you gift a swipe to somebody, that's completely free. And it prevents them from getting one of those crazy charges for jumping a turnstile. We were talking and preparing for this segment. There is a whole group of enforcement agents that work with the MTA that work on the SBS buses, and they will come and, you know, it happened to me today, it happened to me yesterday, and they come through the bus and they look for if you have your SBS ticket, and if you don't, they pull you off of the bus and make kind of, you know, they try to do it quietly, but you're getting pulled off the bus, so it's a little bit of a spectacle. And then they let the bus go on, and you have to prove that either you purchased a Metro or a pass, or you have a Metro card. And, you know, it seems to me like it's an overbearing policy for something like that. I can't imagine that there would be so much loss on SBS buses that it would warrant having all of these officers to work to patrol SBS buses. Like, I feel like that money could be
used to make
fares cheaper.
Exactly. Or arresting all these black and brown people for jumping a turnstile could be better used to giving them free Metro cards and, like, letting people get on the damn train for free.
You think about how much an officer makes hourly.
Yeah.
Like, that could probably buy a weekly pass for some people.
I mean, recently the NYPD invested like over $50 million in a propaganda campaign to increase diversity in their ranks, pretty much, to make it like, oh, we need more black and brown cops and blah, blah, blah. Imagine if that $50 million went to, like, not arresting people for hopping the damn turnstile.
$50 million.
Yeah. Or 2 years ago, there was more than $100 million invested in the police just to get 1,300 new cops to also arrest black and brown people for small things like that. All that money could have been used to give poor people a ride to work, a ride to and from work.
We know that the police budget is the highest expenditure that we have in New York City. It's
comparable to the whole military budget of North Korea.
Wow.
It's an army. It's an army we have. And we, like, just like the military, U.S. military always gets its funding somehow. There's never a question about where's the money going to come from. With the NYPD, it's the same thing. Well, they always get their money. They always get what they want.
And you know, when they're not getting what they want, or when they don't think they're going to get the money, they launch a public campaign
to
get that money. Yes. So we're going to continue this conversation. We come back, we're going to play a little bit of music. And then I want to hear from your perspective, what's it all about? Are we getting the story right about the anti-fascist movements? Are we getting the story that we need to get? I don't think we are. So I'm curious to find out what you think. We're right here on Objection to the Rule. You can always find us online at Twitter, Objection Free BK, or on Facebook, Objection Radio Free Brooklyn. We'll be right back in just a moment, right here on Objection to the Rule.
Which side are you on, friend? Which side are you on? Which side?
Which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on?
Silence is unappreciated.
Which side are you on?
I'm gonna go ahead and take this disrespect.
Which side are you on?
Silence is death, yes.
Which side are you on?
Get off the fence, son.
Which side are you on?
Get off the fence, son.
Which side are you on?
Who stands to defend us?
Which side are you on?
If you ain't with us, you against us.
We drawing a line in the sand. With us or against us, gotta decide where you stand. There's an angel and a demon inside of every man. It's completely up to you, getting the upper hand.
Which side are you on?
I make my music for the people. Survival guide and ruthless, we confusing it with evil. When I say the people, I don't just mean the ones that agree with me. I'm on the side of the people, regardless of who they seem to be following.
Which side are you on?
Get off the fence, son.
Which side are you on?
Get off the fence, son.
Which side are you on?
Who stands to defend us?
Which side are you on?
With us, you against us.
No.
Get off the fence, son.
Yeah.
Get off the bench, son.
Yeah.
Who stands to defend us?
No.
If you ain't with us, you against us.
Ain't none of these deaths making sense. Nothing is sacred when you suffering to pay your rent. Celebrities be making money off the powerless. They silence in the face of injustice, it's just cowardice. I roll with a crew that ain't never scared of the challenges. We don't wait for the tragedies. Freedom is the catalyst. We don't call in the cavalry. We the leaders we waiting on. You standing up for justice to trust us. This is your famous song. They want us brought up in more legal drama than law and order. And the streets police is on trial and rappers is the court reporters. You won't be more than one of them lambs. They fat enough for the slaughter. If you don't pull your weight and draw your water for our daughters. How a kid without a gun become a threat to cops where they let him shot, hoping his head will pop and that his breath will stop. We gotta be satisfied with waiting until we get the verdict. It's just perverted, no justice for the family of the kid they murdered.
If they roadblock us, Martin on my arm. With the struggle made me more Malcolm. Demon in the smoke, Kush burning like Ferguson. Fuck Obama and Don Lemon, nigga, the nerve in him. CNN, CNN, but they ain't seeing him. Tears of the tear gas, tears of the Elohim. POE the priest, hit a pig with a prison shank. God got me copy, I ain't scared of a fucking tank. Glorious struggle, shout out my brother Tory Russell. When I die, die in the middle, bye bye, don't put a bullet hole in my spleen. The millennium with Pops Indians and no Zionists in my dreams. Don't kill me for that line, conceal me with flat lines. I don't believe in no laws, I don't believe in your God. It's your block for my black freedom, put a car bomb in your heart. Black child, ain't no love in this bitch. Feed your seed and get your chopper like the government did. POE.
Which side are you on?
Get off the fence, son.
Which side are you on?
Get off the bench, son.
Which side are you on?
Who stands to defend us? If you ain't with us, you against us.
Which side are you on?
Get off the fence, son.
Which side are you on?
Get off the bench, son.
Which side are you on?
Who stands to defend us? If you ain't with us, you against us.
Which side are you on?
Welcome back to Objection to the Rule, live on Radio Free Brooklyn. For the last few minutes of the show, we are going to talk to our guest, Asha Kajegru, friend of mine, journalist, who's been covering movements, protest movements, for pretty much as long as I've known you. Mm-hmm. And you have some really interesting insight on kind of what is happening right now. So I want to, first, we talked a little bit about the president's response. I'm more concerned about what you know about what happened in Virginia. I know you weren't necessarily there, but you have a lot of contacts with people that were. So what are we not hearing about what happened in Charlottesville?
Well, I have a lot of friends who were injured in that car attack as well. I have friends who just came up, you know, with canes and stuff like that, having hospital bills, quite frankly. I mean, one of the things that you don't hear about, I guess, is just the level of violence on the side of the damn the fascists. I mean, this equivocating the both sides stuff really permeates also like centrists and liberals as well. Mm-hmm. This idea that, well, these anti-fascists are out there as well provoking these right wingers. They're violent all on their own. Trust mm-hmm. me. Whether you're there or not, they're going to be violent and they're going to like advocate for further violence in the future. What these rallies are all about, you know, planning for future events where they're going to be violent. And so these need to be stamped out very when they're at their smallest and weakest. Right now, they need to be stamped out. Mm-hmm. And also, the people who are out there are leftists. They're not liberals. I heard Bill Maher on his show talking about us when he was talking about the counter-protest. Liberals like him weren't out there. Mm-hmm. It was people from, you know, DSA, communists, socialists, anarchists, Black Lives Matter protesters, people who are considered radical, who are often trashed in the media, in the mainstream media. They were out there defending our freedoms, quite frankly.
This idea, because it's something that really kind of came out in the last election because a lot of people didn't understand what the difference between leftist and liberal and kind of what those distinctions mean. What, from your perspective, what do those distinctions mean?
Well, a liberal is pretty much someone who wants to keep the system as it is as much as possible while changing as little as possible in order to make it seem like it's all good, pretty much. Well, so, and a leftist is somebody who's opposed to capitalism, first and foremost. If you want to overthrow capitalism, I think that puts you squarely on the left, as opposed to a liberal who wants to just like put window dressings on the current system, the current status quo.
So it's this idea that we're either going to, you know, there's this, we're going to try this like piecemeal change, or we're going to deconstruct the whole system.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, people like Hillary Clinton, for example, or the Democratic Party, quite frankly, the whole Democratic Party is just liberal, just liberalism personified, pretty much.
So why is that idea that kind of...
And they weren't out in the streets. They're not in the streets.
That very like blasé type of belief about what's happening now. Why is that detrimental? Why is that harmful to these progressive movements, or to, you know, our liberation, the idea of our liberation as marginalized people?
Why is liberalism a danger? Well, as you can see, the failure of the liberals has led to a fascist movement taking power in the damn country. And I mean, their failures to address the real problems that people face have pushed people to the right. I mean, if you talk to all these right wingers and stuff like that, the people they hate most are the so-called SJWs. And in their head, we're all liberals, all the leftists. We're all like, you know, Hillary Clinton, Nancy Pelosi or whatever in their heads. We're all like that. We all just want, you know, just little piecemeal changes, and we don't care about poor people or whatever. Whereas if we had a real like left wing movement in this country that could address like real systemic problems, I think a lot of these people would not have gravitated to the right the way they did. And now, you know, once they're in there, they pretty much the racism, the xenophobia kind of just saturates into them and become Nazis in no time. I mean, it's pretty much the failure of these liberals that has caused the rise of somebody like Donald Trump.
I think that for me, you look at the party and you there was what was said, what was like, oh, they're trying to do this, and there was what actually happened. And we realize that what gets said does not really gel with what actually happens. Is there a way that we can get what we want out of our current political system? Do you see that possibility, or do you absolutely not? And if so, what does it take for us to get what we need and what we want?
I mean, this current political system is trash, quite frankly. You know how I feel about this. I'm a radical. I think we need to overthrow the state, overthrow capitalism, overthrow the myriad of oppressive hierarchies that exist in society that make up this society, quite frankly. White supremacy, heteronormativity, cisnormativity, all these oppressive hierarchies reinforce each other and support each other. And they are what this society is, the status quo is. And we need to dismantle all of these hierarchies in order to get liberation, pretty much, in order to get, you know, what we want. In order so we don't, you know, have people dying in the streets because they can't afford health care, or people being brutalized by police forces just because they're black or brown, or people being thrown out of the country just because they crossed some imaginary line and they didn't get the right papers for it or something like that. That all of these things can be given like little band-aids under the current system, but they can't truly be solved under this current system, in my opinion.
Do you think that there's even a desire to solve them from certain parts of the system?
Definitely not. I mean, the Democratic establishment is an epitome of not wanting to really solve problems, but just want to keep themselves in power. I think sometimes they want to like perpetuate some of these problems in order to present a bullshit. Oh, can I say it?
You can say
it. A BS solution. I mean, 10, 20 years ago, the Clintons were talking about, you know, we got to be tough on crime and super predators and stuff like that. And just when the, you know, when you can't use that anymore, that kind of rhetoric anymore, they'll change it just like that. Just based on, you know, what the polls say, the stats say, whatever. They're not out to solve problems. They're out to keep their positions of power and make you think they're out there looking out for you. But like Malcolm said, they're foxes pretty much, and the Republicans are wolves. The only reason they're there is make it look like they're smiling when they're showing their teeth, but they're going to bite you just the same.
What are some of the groups that are doing this work that people should be paying more attention to. You know, we've got a lot of visibility to white supremacist groups. I feel like they've been rattling off names and talking about names. But what are some of these groups that are working within this, you know, whatever, now this umbrella that they've put people under, this anti-fascist umbrella? But what are some of these groups that are actually doing this work to change this system or break the system down?
Well, the groups that I saw that go that I know personally that went down to Charlottesville here in New York were groups like Black Lives Matter Greater New York went down there, where the Workers' Royal Party is a communist party here. NYC Shut It Down, which is an anti-police brutality led by people of color group. Just mostly, you know, lefty groups like that were down there. The groups that, you know, get shitted on mostly by the mainstream press around here, get called radicals, fringe or whatever. They're down. They're the ones actually doing the work on the streets, fighting fascism, and also stuff here like Swipe It Forward, helping people get on the train, or you know, doing court support when you know when people get out of court, giving them food, giving them cigarettes, giving them access to a lawyer, telling them where they can go to get a lawyer, real stuff to meet people's concrete needs, serving the people. Those are the groups that are really doing it.
One thing that you talked about earlier, and I want to ask before we go, we only have a couple of minutes left, that idea of violence and how it gets miscategorized. And you think, you know, one of the arguments from the left that I hear all the time is that you can't, you know, if we want change, we have to do it positively. We have to do it without violence. And I just think like that has never happened in the course of history.
Ahistorical, totally ahistorical, yeah.
How do we change that narrative? Is there a way that quickly that we can start changing that narrative? Because it doesn't make any sense.
I mean, just letting people frame it in terms of violence is a mistake to begin with, I think. I mean, Angela Davis had a great, like, you know, reply to somebody asking her about, you know, the Black Power movement's violence on their side or whatever. I mean, you're asking the wrong side about violence. I mean, the fascists are the violent ones. They want to commit genocide. They want to, like, mass kick people out of this country, which will cause death and destruction and misery. I mean, when you frame it as violence, you're missing the point and you're losing the context. When you fight against fascism, I mean, that's a different kind of violence than when you like throwing someone in a camp. Those are very different things.
We had a war. We literally had a global war. Yeah,
exactly. We will glorify the Allied powers, even though they were violent as hell. Mm. But then today, if you punch a Nazi, then you're violent, quote unquote.
I don't understand it. I hope we figure out how we can reconcile and actually move forward to help the people that need help, because this is really about people that need help. Thank you so much, Asuka, for joining us. Thank you, Violet, as always. And thank you all for listening to Objection to the Rule. We'll be back next week with more resistance right here on Radio Free Brooklyn. Bye, everyone.